Good afternoon, listeners. This is Return from Babylon, Lecture 2, Episode 1 of 3. In the previous episode, we stopped at the part where King Koresh, Koresh meaning buddy in Russian, or Cyrus as he's known in the non-Jewish tradition, decreed that the Jews may return to the land of Israel. It's written in the Talmud, if I'm not mistaken, in the tractate Rosh Hashanah, Koresh comes from the word kosher. If you rearrange the letters, you get the same word, so that makes him a kosher king. We talked about how King Koresh comes to power and conquers Babylon. We also talked about how the Jewish prophet Daniel, called Sheshbazar, by the Persians, revealed Isaiah's prophecy, which talks about King Koresh and the Jews returning from Babylon. So astounded by this prophecy was King Koresh that not only did he release the Jews, but gave them many gifts to take back to the land of Israel. There are some interesting facts to note about the Persians, so one can better understand how they viewed the Jews and the world in general. The Persian Empire in the 5th century BCE was probably the greatest empire in the world. When we celebrate the Purim holiday, we read the most Persian book of the Tanakh, Megillat Esther, the Book of Esther. It tells a story about a king called Ahasuerus, who ruled over 120 nations. If we fully grasp what Persia and the Persian Empire were, we'll have a better understanding of the events that followed. Dariavesh, commonly known as Darius the Great, was a Persian ruler who decided to construct a road which would connect two parts of Persia, from the kingdom of Kush, today's Ethiopia, all the way to present-day India. The road was almost 2,500 kilometers long and still exists today. It crossed over mountains in very rough terrain. This was not just an ordinary road made of packed dirt, but a layer of gravel was added for drainage that prevented runoff from rain from washing the road away. Back then, asphalt did not exist. This gravel, in effect, kept the road free of mud. This road was built 2,500 years ago and covered 2,500 kilometers. So you can imagine how large this empire was. Why were the kings of Persia so, shall I say, fond of the Jews? Or as the expression goes, with friends like the Persians, who needs enemies? Now what do I mean by that? The Book of Esther tells how King Ahasuerus' prime minister, Haman, was so fond of the Jews that he tried to wipe them out completely. But friends like Haman, who needed enemies? The Persians practiced a very interesting religion called Zoroastrianism, also known as fire worshipping, because they had a cult of fire. To this day, there are still practicing Zoroastrians in Iran, but they are being oppressed, and not many of them remain. The theory behind Zoroastrianism might explain why the Persians had such a huge empire. Interestingly, they believed there is only one god called Ahura Mazda. Maybe the Iranians should sue the Japanese automaker for stealing that name. The Persians believed that their supreme deity, Ahura Mazda, created two opposing forces of good and evil. He created the day and the sun, which symbolized good, and the night and the darkness, which symbolized evil. They believe that Ahura Mazda does not interfere with the human world. Rather, he's like a spectator at a boxing match between good and evil. He looks on while good and evil fight each other and roots for the forces of good to win. But because humans have freedom of choice, Ahura Mazda wants them to do their part. After death, the winners go to paradise and the losers go to hell. According to Zoroastrianism, everyone should live in peace and harmony. And surprisingly enough, all Persian kings considered themselves to be total pacifists. They wanted people to smile at each other, say nice things, and live in peace in a kind of earthly paradise. But if they were such pacifists and proponents of peace, why then did they constantly fight and seize more and more new lands? Ahura Mazda's goal is world peace, and they believe this can only be achieved if there is one ruling power. While there's more than one ruling power, there can be no peace. So how did the Persian kings try to achieve Ahura Mazda's goal of world peace? They viewed themselves as that single power that stood for good, and therefore they must seize control of all territories and consolidate power in order to achieve their noble goal. This caused hundreds of thousands of casualties in the process and was not viewed as contrary to the pacifist ideals, because in the end, they would be the one power that stands for good, ruling over all territories, doing good things throughout these territories, and all the survivors of their sieges will be happy and at peace. There would be no more conflicts or wars. Why? Because there would be one unified empire. Overall, the Persians were tolerant towards the peoples they conquered. They believed that each nation, which became part of the great Persian Empire, should have its own ruler and live as it pleases, but only as long as they understand that the king of Persia who presides in the Persian capital is the representative of Ahura Mazda, then all will be well and there will be peace. Anyway, Sheshbazzar, who is the prophet Daniel, was by this time very, very old. He makes the first aliyah, or return to the land of Israel, from Persia. Bringing part of the temple utensils, he heads to Jerusalem. There were over 42,000 people who were part of this aliyah in the year 534 before the Common Era. Not many at all. This aliyah was led by great men, Zerubbabel ben Salatiel and Yehoshua ben Yehotzadak, who later became the high priest of the reconstructed temple. It could be said that their arrival in Jerusalem marked the beginning of the Second Temple period. One more thing before we continue. We talked about parallels between the Jewish diaspora living under 70 years under Babylonian rule and 70 years under Soviet rule. The Jews were forbidden to leave, and most Jews assimilated. When the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 90s, Gorbachev allowed Jews to immigrate to Israel. Similarly, when King Koresh came to power, he said that all Jews may return to Israel. We also talked about the differences, how life for people in the Soviet Union was one of cold and hunger, while in Israel life was good. Maybe now, life has improved in Russia, but back then, at least compared to the Soviet Union, life was much better in Israel. That's why the massive so-called sausage aliyah began. Many left right away. Not everyone went to Israel. Some went to America. Rabbi Gedalia Sheshtayak's family went to Australia. But most Jews went to Israel only because it was easier. The situation, however, in Babylon was quite different. The Jews who had been living in Babylon for 70 years were like the Jews of Gibraltar. The Jewish community of Gibraltar is much admired, and its members were wealthy and highly respected, and the majority were Sephardic. It's like a Jewish Klondike, a golden age of Jewish life in the modern world. The image of life in Gibraltar conjures up images of wealth and comfort, and the Jews of Babylon were very much like the envied Jewish community of Gibraltar. Even though the Persians and the Babylonians exiled the Jews from Israel, they didn't really oppress them. And that's why the Jews were able to live well and even prosper. Then came King Koresh with Ahura Mazda's mantra of, "We must have peace in the entire world, even if we have to kill half the world's population in order to have peace for everyone." Then Koresh grants the Jews total freedom. Want to go to Israel? Go. Want to stay there? Okay, stay. Israel had been in ruins for almost 52 years. It was no place anyone would want to go. There weren't any cities or Jewish settlements. You had to start over from scratch. Nevertheless, over 42,000 people with Zerubbabel in the lead were heading to Jerusalem. When the Jews arrived, they witnessed a terrible scene. For 52 years, Jerusalem had laid in ruins. You can imagine what a post-war city might look like. A desolate place with rubble, overgrown with weeds and scattered remains of the dead. The Temple Mount was also in ruins. There were no city walls, nothing, just gangs of thieves roaming around in the scorching heat. Spending the night in Jerusalem was like sleeping on the streets of any desolate place. When the Jews returned to Jerusalem, it was completely uninhabitable. Where Jerusalem once stood were ruins. There was no Jerusalem. Over 42,000 people who had come on the trip, many of whom were elderly, returned not to the same place they once left, but to a place more like ground zero. They arrived in Jerusalem. It's written that many of those people tried to find the city they were from, but all the cities lay in ruins, so the people went to where they once lived and began restoring the ruins. Meanwhile, the Jews that decided to remain in Babylon were well off and living in comfort, thinking how great it was that the brave ones went ahead to resettle the homeland. The Jews that stayed in Babylon waited to see what would happen. If there would be a happy ending, they would come too. But if the end is not so happy, they would say, "Well, yeah, we told you it was too soon to go back. You should have stayed in Babylon." In essence, this was the main mistake and problem. Why the return from Babylon wasn't a global geula, a redemption, the return of the Jewish people to their homeland. Nevertheless, Zerubbabel, with a group of friends, stated that the first order of business must be the restoration of the temple. And so after 52 years, the restoration of the temple began. It may not be easy for us living in the 21st century to understand what the temple meant to the Jews 2,500 years ago. The temple was like the heart of the universe. A person can't live without a heart. When the heart is removed, it needs to be replaced with an artificial one. It's not easy to live with an artificial heart, though. It beats, a person can eat, a person can drink, sleep, etc. But it's not a real heart. When one's real heart is suddenly restored, one's youth and strength are restored, and one becomes a new person. The Jewish people without a temple were like a human body without a heart. It's possible to survive with an artificial one, but not to thrive. That's why it was necessary to restore the heart of the Jewish people. And the heart of the Jewish people is the Temple of Jerusalem. So now what's been done 500 years before must be done again. The temple must be rebuilt. For the construction of the temple, the Jews, being very conservative, had to turn to the same sources that supplied the building materials for the first temple, built by King Solomon. So where did they turn? They turned to the territory of the present-day Lebanon, a walled city called Tyre. We'll be talking about the city a lot more. In the city of Tyre, back in Solomon's time, 500 years previously, there was a king named Hiram. King Hiram supplied Solomon with most expensive building material of the ancient world for the construction of the temple. What was the most expensive material of the ancient world? It was the cedars of Lebanon. Lebanese cedar was like mahogany today. This is probably the most expensive building material that existed at that time. So Zerubbabel sent messages to Tyre to say, "We have returned. We want the same arrangement as before, 500 years ago, when you supplied us with Lebanese cedar, so we can rebuild the Temple of Jerusalem." On the first of Iyar in the year 534 before the Common Era, the Jews began reconstructing the temple. The book of Ezra describes this. The Kohanim sound their pipes. The Leviim sing. Many are missing a finger, but whoever is able to play the lyre plays it. It was an amazing sight. 40,000 people all gathered at the wreckage that was Jerusalem, and they were witnessing the restoration of the temple taking place. And it says, "The young people rejoiced, the old people cried, because they remembered the glory of the temple that they had lost." The young people were just happy to have the temple. There was weeping and tears, and they became the symbol of the entire Second Temple era, most of which was filled with sorrow. The Jews will be ruled by foreign nations, but there will also be fleeting moments of happiness and celebration, like on the 24th of Kislev when we celebrate Hanukkah, and the time the Jews will regain independence from foreign rule, if only for a short period of time. As soon as the Jews began rebuilding the temple, they received a visit from some locals. To better understand the time we are talking about, it was a lot like our time, more precisely like the 20th century. When the Jews first returned to the land of Israel, when they arrived, the land of Israel was pretty much desolate. It was at the end of the 19th century. The land was inhabited by other peoples. Who are these people? They were Arabs. The Arabs didn't have large cities. They were mostly nomadic tribes, which are now called Bedouins. They lived in Jaffa, Haifa, and in Jerusalem. But Jews lived in Jerusalem too, among the Arabs. Anyhow, the Jews had been absent from this land for many centuries. That is, there was a small presence, but it was minimal. Like the saying goes, there's always someone to fill a void. When the Jews left this land, others came and called themselves the owners of the land and claimed to be its rightful owners. Who are we referring to? We're talking about the ones who are known as the Samaritans, or as they're often called, Kutim. Kutim come from the Kutha region, which is near present-day Afghanistan. Most of the people who lived there came from this territory. So what's the story with these Kutim, these Samaritans? We will be talking about them and how they interacted with Jews and obstructed the reconstruction of the temple in the next episode.